The content of this podcast could contain triggering information that may not be suitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised. Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you're listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. The purpose of my podcast is to destigmatize mental illness and to bring awareness of many of the uncomfortable subjects that are not being talked about in terms of trauma. I am not an expert about trauma. I've just lived it. I was sexually abused as a young child by my father and have developed multiple traumas over the years. My own experience does not equate to knowing everything about everyone else's experience with trauma. For the most part, I am just learning about many of the ways people experience trauma through this podcast. One of the topics that I've heard about a lot, but knew so little about, was human trafficking. Joining me today is Catherine McGibbons, advocate and a trauma survivor of human trafficking. She is also the founder of 1211, an organization birthed from her experience and passion to help communities combat sex trafficking and provide resources for other survivors. Kathy, thank you so much for talking with me today to educate me on this subject.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate the platform that you provided for us to be able to talk about this very difficult issue and to provide a platform to share my story.
Unfortunately, you lived with an unspeakable trauma of being trafficked. But you know, you are thriving more than so many people would, you know, as a survivor. You're using your experience to advocate for others, and you have even authored a book. Can you tell my listeners a little bit about your story?
It is my passion, my desire, and my goal to educate the community as much as possible and make people aware of what human trafficking really is. And so my story starts, I like to tell people a little bit about my background. So I was raised in Canada, raised in a wonderful faith-based home with my mom. My dad did leave at an early age, but my mom did such a wonderful job providing for me and my siblings that I really felt like I was in a healthy home. I didn't feel any voids. We had our stuff because she was a single mom, but she really tried to make us feel, you know, safe, protected. And because she was a single mom, she raised us to be independent and strong. And so that's kind of how I grew up. One summer, my mom decided to take a trip to Texas. She said, we're going to take a vacation because we have some family in Texas and it's going to be great. And we're going to go and see them. And got to Texas and it was a culture shock because everything was different. But I was excited because it was vacation. Well, that excitement quickly turned into I was just depressed. I was just sad and shocked because my mom decided to move to Texas. But there was no like going back home to pack. There was no going back to Canada to pack and say goodbye to friends. All the friends that I said goodbye to expected me back. And so when she said, no, you're actually going to stay here and start school, I was a hot mess. Like, I did not know anything about Texas. Immediately, that vacation thrill just became this like terrifying experience because I was at that age to be entering high school. It was very difficult for me to adjust and find my niche because I left Canada playing with Barbie dolls and dolls and playing outside and, you know, just being a kid. But in the South, it was just so much different. People, you know, the girls were looking at boys and boys were looking at girls and you had to like have this boyfriend and you had to have this image. And it was just and it may have just been like the whole high school thing, right? Because my high school wasn't like that in Canada. So I think high school in America was just a little bit different. It was fast, but I made it through high school. I found my love, ROTC. I loved serving the community. I found a really good church. I was raised in church. My grandmother kept me there. And so when I found a really good church with some really fun youth that I can relate to, and we, you know, we started hanging out and having fun, it was kind of my way through high school. I was like, okay, you know, I might not look like everyone or dress like everyone, but at least I have something to relate to in this new place called Texas. And my mom, just to back up a little bit, my mom was the type of person, you know, once in high school, there was no like, hey, if you make good grades, you get to go to this party. Or if you make good grades, you get to go spend the night at people's houses. My mom wasn't that kind of mom. She was very protective. And so it was just like, you're just going to go to school and make good grades because that's what you're going to do. And you get to sleep here. That's it, right? There was no other negotiation. And so I was raised pretty, you know, she had a pretty tight hold on me and my siblings. And so just very strict household, right? So when I did graduate, went to college, got an opportunity to go to school. I was introduced to a group of guys that were in a band, and they were fun and they were talented. And I was introduced to them through a mutual friend. And so they started, you know, they would perform in around town, and they were well known and very popular. They were like local celebrities. And I was never exposed to that type of life because, like I said, I was raised in a very strict household. So when they started inviting us to, you know, these parties and these concerts, and we would have VIP access. And so it was just really fun. You know, we did what young adults do, and, you know, we weren't like heavily into drugs or anything like that. It was just, you know, having fun. Even though I was in school, my mom was still the same mom. I was still living under her roof, and she was like, hey, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go to school. You know, when I graduated from high school, I had a child, and I don't really like to say that when I'm telling the story of my trafficking experience, because that sets the tone, right? Like when you say, well, yeah, I was a teen parent, that sets the tone for like an at-risk youth. And that's not my story, because my mom and my family was so supportive. So my mom helped me with my child and sent me off to college still. So I still had all the opportunities. Nothing held me back, right? Mm-hmm. I was still under her roof. And even though I had a child and even though I was in college, I still had to obey by her rules. And hanging out with these guys, I tested that a little bit, started to change my life, my lifestyle, stay out a little later, skip classes, which was completely out of the norm for me. And we were just having fun. It just seemed like fun. And they started off as friends. And sooner or later, the lead guy, he took interest in me. And he started to tell me everything that I wanted to hear. And he requested to spend more time with me alone, away from my friends. And I did. As a young adult, any guy that tells you you're beautiful and he's handsome and talented and he wants to spend time with you, any young adult, any young girl is going to go for it, right? Right. And so I was head over heels. I was in awe that he was even attracted to me, because I was always like the awkward one, never really fit in. So when he invited me into this, you know, this relationship is what I thought. And that went on for a while, and things were good. And I use that term loosely because I didn't recognize some of the signs. Things were good in my eyes as a young adult. And he romanced me, and we formed a really great relationship for about a year or so. And then towards the end of that time frame, he said that he had this business idea, and he was going to, you know, start his own record label and his own business. And he was already very business minded. He already had the clout. He already had the following. And so there was nothing that he told me about this story that was like a red flag. And the only thing that was surprising to me is that he wanted me to join him on this journey, because I didn't think I had anything to offer. He said, you know, you're smart, and I just want you on my team. We're in this together. And he would use words like that, you know, this is us against the world, and we're going to make all this money, and we're going to come back, and you're going to be able to, you know, take care of your family, and you're just going to be, it's going to be great. And I hesitated a little bit, because I'd never, you know, he was asking me to go out of town with him for, you know, a few months, and I had never been away from my family or friends like that. But I shook it off, because I was like, okay, I'm just being nervous. This is a great opportunity. I can prove to my mom that I'm like, I'm making it and I'm smart. And she had high expectations for me, and I wanted to live up to those expectations. And so when he said, you're going to come back and you're going to be a part owner of this company, and you come back with all this money and all this kind of stuff, it was glamorized, and I fell for it and went with him. Left Houston, Texas, and went to Dallas, Texas, which is literally just a 4-hour drive. And when I got to Dallas, that's when my life changed forever. This charming individual that I grew to know, he turned into like a monster. He was unrecognizable. You know, it was just terrible how he was belittling me. And he had other women there, other girls there. And it was almost like I was introduced into this life without warning. It was like an outer body experience is how I explain it, because it happened so quickly. You know, he had another girl there, you know, had been in life with him for quite some time. He would have her train me and on things to do and the rules of the game, not make eye contact and stuff like that, quotas and all this kind of stuff, and how to dress. And before I knew it, there were men coming to the room. He had taken some pictures of me and the intent was to post them. And then there were men coming to the room and I was forced to do whatever they said, perform whatever sex acts they requested. I knew the term prostitution, but I did not know the term trafficking. But I wouldn't even identify with the term prostitution. I was just like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm in this relationship with this really bad guy and he's asking me to do really bad things. I had no idea what trafficking was.
Wow, that's crazy. I'm so sorry that you had to do that. How long was he grooming you or courting you before this all happened?
So from the time that we met him, his group or his band, the motive was already there, right? So that friendship even, and there are like six stages. So usually they befriend you and they start with the friendship and then they start to intoxicate you, which is inviting me to those concerts, and I'm now drinking and I never drank before, you know. And then they alienate you, so they get you away from your friends, your parents, your support system. They start to break down your moral compass. And in that time I started to have these arguments with my mom, my only support system that I've known forever, you know. I started not to like her. He was planting those seeds.
Right.
The other step is to isolate. So when he invited me into a solo relationship with him, like, hey, I don't want to hang out with your friends anymore. I just want to get to know you. And I interpreted that as like, oh, we're boyfriend and girlfriend. That turned into isolation. So I wasn't even allowed to hang out with my friends anymore. And then after the isolation, you're desensitized. And so everything that I thought was normal and okay, that is completely changed. And now his norm is what's normal for me. So me staying out with him all times of the night and checking in with him. So if I go to the store, I have to make sure that I call, and all these things that I interpreted as a healthy relationship, this is all a part of the grooming process. And then so after they've gotten you to that point, then it's time to capitalize. There was threatening behavior. There was guns. He was always around guns. He was always around. He had a very aggressive behavior. All of that, which I interpreted as, oh, he'll never do that to me, because the only reason he wants me to, quote unquote, act right is because he loves me so much. Just like a DV relationship.
How long were you in Dallas for?
Almost a year. And you know, I wish I could say that, you know, it ended there, but he still was able to talk to me and try to talk me into going back. And, you know, it was just horrible.
Did your mom know where you were? Was she worried that, or did she know that you were going to be gone for a substantial amount of time?
Right. So that is a part of the process of grooming, is to make sure that you're detached from your support system. So when I said that he was creating arguments and creating tension between me and my mother, it got so bad that I moved out of her house and I moved in with a friend, and he made sure that this friend that I was moving in with, she was kind of like hanging with us, right? She was okay with a lot of the things because she was just as naive as I was. She was like, oh, you're just in love and, you know, do you and be free. Even though I'm staying with my friend's father, I know he's talking to my mom and letting her know I'm okay and stuff like that. They're never going to go for, oh, I'm just going to up and leave with the guy. He's like, oh, no, you're not going to tell them that. You're going to tell them that, you know, you got this job, which is true, quote unquote true. You got this job offer and you're going to be gone and you have to go train. And that's literally what I told my support system.
Wow. And so no one thought anything was wrong.
No.
What year was this?
This is 2003.
2003. Wow. And I'm assuming you didn't have a cell phone, right? I'm trying to.
I had a cell phone that he was paying for. So it wasn't mine.
My gosh.
Before I left to Dallas, and this is all hindsight, right? Like before I left to Dallas, he had already had me in brothels and escorting, but I was, and strip clubs. So I was, but I was dibbling and dabbling, right? So he'd say, hey, go to this. And cause he had connections. with the clubs and brothels and stuff like that. And like, hey, you should do this and just try this because I really need some money. I really need a loan. So these little seeds had already been planted, right? And so I was like, you know, I still didn't recognize that as trafficking. And I still didn't reckon, because he didn't have a gun to my head at that point. He was just in so much need. And if you love me, then you help me get this money. And I have this connection. And all you have to do is just go on a date with them. You don't have to do anything. And all you have to do is, you know, stand there and whatever, you know? So he had already planted seeds.
Wow. Oh my gosh. What a story. Why don't you explain to me, what is human trafficking? And you were, I guess, sex trafficked. I guess, could you explain what is human trafficking to me?
Yeah, so basically human trafficking is how I explain it is stealing someone's freedom for profit. Basically, I mean, that's literally what it is. And that's how I explain it. So the federal term, though, is basically taking someone or by fraud, forcing someone by fraud, force, or coercion to perform sex acts against their will. And that immediately becomes trafficking if that person is a minor. So anyone under the age of 18 cannot consent. And so if you are in any way causing this, manipulating this person, coercing this person, forcing this person to perform any type of sex act, that is trafficking.
So, and you said they have to be a minor?
No, it's adults.
Okay.
But if that person is a minor, then it's automatically trafficking. Mm.
So, you know, when I think of human trafficking, I think about, you know, the recent case of Jeffrey Epstein and, you know, his alleged involvement in a sex trafficking ring. You know, before all of this, you know, call me ignorant, but I thought that human trafficking was kind of limited to maybe like border states or, you know, not my neighborhood or, you know, I live in DC, not even in like urban areas. For some reason, I just thought this was like something that's done in the desert, like in, you know, maybe Texas or maybe New Mexico or, you know, but that just simply isn't true, right?
Yeah, you don't need to be moved for it to be human trafficking. So smuggling and human trafficking are different things. A lot of people do have that idea that if it's happening in your neighborhood, then it can't be trafficking. That's just prostitution. And that is absolutely not true. So human trafficking can happen domestically. And so again, that's just any form of like force, fraud, or coercion. If you're inducing someone to sell, to profit off of that person or sell them for sex, that is trafficking.
Okay. And right. You said they don't need to be moved. They can be in some home where people are just in and out. And
yeah.
But the person who is being trafficked can remain there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are different types of trafficking. So there's familial trafficking where families are trafficking their children, right? Or husbands are trafficking their wives. They're not being moved from state to state or even internationally, right? But they are still being trafficked. So they are still being forced or induced to sell their body for sex for profit. So if there's a third party involved, then it is trafficking. I know we talk about, you know, there's sex work and stuff like that, but anytime there is a third party involved that is profiting off of any sex act that is being, you know, forced upon a victim, or if the victim was coerced or manipulated or induced in any manner, and this third party is profiting off of that, that is trafficking. Or if that individual is a minor, it's trafficking, it's a no-brainer.
Wow. And I know I didn't ask you this, but do you happen to know what the statistics are? Like how many people are being affected by human trafficking in this country?
So the statistics are very hard because it's hard to narrow down any stats, right? Because a lot of people do not report trafficking, and data depends on identifying victims of trafficking. And that is a very, very hard thing. Right now, I think they're saying that it's a $600 billion industry for traffickers. So that's, that's 24.9, I think, million people around the world that are being trafficked. And that's a lot of people. But that's only identified victims. So a lot of victims don't, because I know for myself, I didn't start speaking out until I even, I learned what human trafficking was. And I was like, oh, that definition is, that describes what I went through. I think I'm a survivor of it. And then, so I started doing more research and I identified. So it's really hard to get that data, because typically people that are being trafficked do not know that they are being trafficked. And when they do escape that life, it is very hard to get them to, one, identify as a human trafficking survivor, to turn on their traffickers, or to even, to share their story. So the data is inaccurate, even right. though we have like 24 million something people. Yes, those are identified people, identified victims of trafficking.
Wow. Why is the topic of human trafficking not being talked about? I know with Jeffrey Epstein, I feel like people are starting to talk about it more because it's what's happening in the news. But why are we not talking about it? It can happen to what it seems like. It can just happen to your neighbor, the average person who's just, walking down the street.
Right. So the thing with that is that's a question. That's a hot question right now. And the thing with that is there have been people talking about it for years and in this fight for so many years. Mainstream media, however, has not been talking about it. So now they're bringing it to mainstream media, and now it's, this thing, this hot topic that's happening, like it's just been revealed. But quite frankly, the reason why we have so many nonprofit organizations and not enough in the movement of anti-trafficking is because this problem has been identified years ago. And so mainstream media, I think, is just catching up to starting to highlight it. We have a lot of, we have Taken, we have the movie on mainstream, we have some documentaries like Nefarious, but nothing's ever really made it to mainstream like it is now. You know what I mean? In the way that it is now.
With Jeffrey Epstein. Do you think it's because you're talking about white billionaires and that's why people are talking about it now?
I do, absolutely. I think that now we're talking about the one percenters, right? And so now it matters, because again, years in the anti-trafficking movement, we have been fighting against like big tech companies, and we've been fighting against legislators that hold the power in their hands to change some of these laws. But we just were not able to break through. We've been fighting against that for years and years. But yes, now because we're talking about billionaires, white billionaires, the one percenters, the people that hold the power to change the laws, now because we're talking about them possibly being affected, it's a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, it's taken that to bring it to light. But fortunately for the anti-trafficking movement and those who have been talking about this for some while, we are absolutely ready to have these conversations, and not just conversations. We're absolutely ready for change. And so we'll take it how we can get it. If we need to capitalize off of this moment, then we absolutely will.
Absolutely. We should all be listening. So yeah. Thank you. What are the common misconceptions about human trafficking?
I think one of the biggest things is that, I think we covered it, so internationally, that this is a border problem. Human trafficking is a border problem, but it's not only a border problem. This human trafficking, sex trafficking happens right here in our community. So if you walk outside of your house and you look around in your beautiful community, there is trafficking that is happening. And so I think once we take off our blinders and understand that this is not just a border problem, then we can all join the fight. Another misconception is that traffickers, they look a certain way, and that most trafficking of victims happen like in abductions with like these, you know, there's the white van and the dark windows, and they're gonna like snatch the girl and drive away. Though that does happen, a lot of times it happens between a trusted individual, right? It happens with someone that the victim trusts. And this goes for minors and adults. In my case, I was a young adult. I was 21. I trusted this individual because I had some time to spend with this individual. So there's an organization called Traffic 911, and they did some research regarding the calls that they would get to their hotline, and not one victim that they worked with that was identified as a victim said that they were abducted. It was always a trust-based relationship. It always happened through coercion, right? And so I think that's another big misconception too. And then, you know, traffickers, there's no one single profile for traffickers, and there's not a single profile for trafficked individuals. So they are targeting minors, they are targeting boys, they are targeting girls, they are targeting men, they are targeting women of all ages, all sizes, all ethnicities, every demographic. So sex trafficking does not discriminate.
Do you believe that this person who basically got you into this situation, he already had his eye on you, he already had his plan? Did you appear vulnerable where they could actually exploit that?
That's a wonderful, I'm so glad that you brought it up, because that's how I describe trafficking and targets for traffickers. Sex trafficking targets vulnerabilities, not necessarily people. They look for vulnerabilities. So in my case, I prefaced, you know, my growing up, my upbringing in this wonderful, fabulous household, right? Well, I had an absent parent, and even though my mother was wonderful, she did everything, I didn't know that I had a void like that until this individual started telling me things that I never even knew I wanted to hear. You're beautiful. My mom told me that I was beautiful every day, but coming from a man who was absent from my household, it was a wonderful feeling, right? And so there was my vulnerability. I desired a father figure. I desired a man. Even though I came from a solid household, I desired that father figure that I didn't even know that I had. Vulnerability could be, especially right now, kids post their feelings on social media. They're looking. Social media is what I call a trafficker's hunting ground. They are always looking for things to create a facade, like they relate to your vulnerabilities. So if you're saying I had a bad day, or I have a pimple, or, you know, all of us can say honestly that we have been vulnerable at one point in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. All of us have vulnerabilities. And so those are the things that traffickers are looking for. If you're a single mom, well, hey, I can help you with your kids. If you're a college student that's stressed and, you know, stressed out and, you know, no time for fun, hey, I can introduce you to some fun. Or you're a struggling college student and need to pay for your tuition, I can help you pay for your tuition. So all of these vulnerabilities, that's what traffickers use to target their victims.
Wow, I feel like that's so interesting that you say that about social media, because you're right. A lot of, you know, younger adults, older kids, they go on social media, they talk about everything. It's like their diary. That is a place for someone who is hunting to find their victim. As a parent yourself, and me, I have a young daughter and a young son. My children are still really young, but like, what advice do you give?
Yeah, so we want to start with prevention first, right? So even though your children are very young, you still want to have those conversations. You're not going to use terms like trafficking and the big scary. You're not going to use that, but you want to talk about personal boundaries, right? And personal space and the boundaries as far as like, okay, who can touch where? You want to start that as young as possible. So you're developing their children to value themselves and their bodies and be aware that their bodies are not commodities, right? And so as they get older, then you can start introducing some content that has to do more with trafficking and predators and what to be aware of. And then I would say, especially for the older teens, you got to be in your kids' business. So we talked about social media, right? Even for the younger kids, a lot of our kids these days, they have smartphones. And, you know, I ask this question when I present. If your child said, hey, can I invite like 100 friends over right now to, and we're all going to go in my room? You would probably, number one, pass out and then say no, right? like no. But when you give them access to that smartphone and they're up in their room, they have access to all of those people, right? So all of these social media apps, there are a lot of them that are very, very dangerous for kids to be unsupervised on, right? And so we want to make sure that we're in our kids' business, not to make them afraid of their phone or social media or the internet, but you want to make them very, very aware that bad things can happen. And so there are some apps that even tell your location and all of that. You're checking in with strangers. A lot of the victims that we've seen have been recruited and groomed on social media before they actually were trafficked. And so that's a very, when they're older teens, you have to talk to your kids about sex. If you're not talking to your kids about sex and what that looks like to value your body and yourselves, someone else will do that job and they're not going to value your child. And so we definitely want to have those uncomfortable conversations. Just do it and just talk about it.
When it comes to sexual assault, I feel like there's this thread, right? It's this, a lot of the people talked about how when they were younger, you know, parents didn't have that conversation about sex. They didn't have conversations about, you know, your body and boundaries. And it's interesting because I felt like that was the thread. The parents never had these conversations about appropriate behaviors, appropriate relationship. And I think the survivors who I spoke with, they were not trafficked, but they were assaulted by someone they loved and someone they trusted. And so that made it even harder. I think, you know, having the conversation about boundaries and relationships and your body is a really, really important conversation to have as a parent. And I really appreciate you mentioning that and honestly validating, because I know that that is a really hard topic to have with a child.
It is, yeah.
You know, I'm assuming that, you know, if you were out on the street or, you know, when, like you said, you were left and kind of abandoned by this guy for one night, did you feel like someone would have looked at you and said, maybe I should help her? Like, how do people actually identify someone who is being trafficked?
So good that you asked that. So when I was actually nearing my exit was very dramatic, right? I didn't have like Vice come in and rescue me or anything like that, but it was extremely dramatic in the point that I was having like some mental breakdown issues, right? Over it because of the trauma. I encountered or engaged with three churches. And this is not to call out the faith community at all. Like, I'm a woman of faith, so I'm not calling them out. We consider like faith communities or churches, like a part of our community as like social support, right? Regardless of your religion or whatever, that's kind of like the go-to for like, oh, they're going to help. So I encountered three different churches upon my exit, and each of them turned me away because I looked a certain way. I wasn't dressed appropriately, obviously, for any church service, but I was really crying for help. I didn't know that I was being trafficked, but I knew that I needed help. And I was like, can you please like help me? But I probably sounded like a crazy lady. I probably looked a little homeless, and I was turned away. That experience really spoke to me. And again, this is not to shame the faith community, but as a community as a whole, we really need to do better about being sensitive to those around us so that we can really see the unseen. But if you encounter someone that is not making eye contact is the number one no-no. If you encounter someone that is with an individual and that individual is doing all of the speaking on that person's behalf, that's another indication that this person may need help. If you know a person well enough and you're having a conversation with a person, you know, you've encountered a girl, you know, a couple of times, and every time that you see this person, their story is changing. Like, as far as where they live, they may not know what city they're in. They may not, you know, hey, what school do you go to? They may not know. What school did you graduate from? They're not going to answer you, or their answers change. So a lot of inconsistencies in their stories. And then obviously you want to look for signs like bruising and stuff like that, and malnutrition. So severely underweight. But those are just a few examples.
We talk about trauma a lot on my show. You know, it's a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. But sex trafficking, you know, what does that do to a person's mentality? How did this experience affect you, and how did you get out of it?
So recovering from sex trafficking is a lifelong journey. It's a lot of complex trauma. So when you think of trafficking, you immediately go to the trafficker, right? And you're like, okay, there may have been some abuse on the traffic by the trafficker. But think about the buyers. Think about the times that this person, this individual, is forced to have sex, be raped by multiple individuals, strangers that she might never see again. And a lot of the buyer encounters are violent. Buyers want to live out their fantasies and they use you as an object to do it. There's a lot of trauma both ways. And so there's a deep, deep trauma when it comes to sex trafficking. A lot of victims are left with insomnia, fear, always looking over their shoulder. It's really hard to trust anyone. And a lot of these things, they may sound familiar to anyone else that has endured any kind of trauma. It makes it hard to even go forward in healthy relationships because you've been broken so many times by these individuals, traffickers, and buyers. And so for me personally, my healing journey was very personalized. It's individualized to all, obviously, but I had to really just write out my thoughts and just try to come to terms with, okay, I'm not to blame. I'm not to blame here. And it's not an easy process. So even still, that was 2003. Even still today, I get triggers. I have reminders. I have nightmares. It just doesn't go away. It gets better and you learn how to manage it, but it doesn't go away. So restoration for a trafficking survivor is a lifelong process. My exit was very dramatic in the sense that there was no vice, but one of the young ladies that he had trafficked, she became very ill because she struggled with mental illness to the point where he couldn't handle her. And the normal thing in that situation would be to like, okay, abuse her and leave her, right? But this individual happened to be the mother of his child, so he couldn't do that. Because there would be people asking, well, what happened to her? Where is she, right? And so I convinced him that we needed to get her back to her doctors, which were in Houston. And he listened. And so we were able to get back to Houston. And that's when I had a severe, severe mental breakdown to the point, again, where he couldn't handle me. He was him by himself at that point because all of his entourage had left. And he couldn't handle me because I was just outrageous. And so he actually allowed me to call my brother. And my brother and my sister-in-law, they came and picked me up from this hotel room. And I was able to leave then. I was able to stay free because I had a very, very, very strong support system waiting when I returned. There's a lot of people worried about me, like, where have you been? What is going on? You're never, like, what did he put his hands on you? And I couldn't verbalize what I went through. I just couldn't. But they knew it was something bad. And when he tried to access me again and, you know, romance me back and charm his way back into my life, I wanted to do it, but because my support system was so strong, they didn't allow me to do it. And so that was, wow. I kind of weaned my way out away from him. That's not the case for a lot of people. A lot of people don't have a strong support system. And so it's very hard to stay away from your trafficker. And when you do leave your trafficker, you end up with another one, or you end up in a very toxic relationship because that's very hard to break.
Wow. Unbelievable. I know that you found 1211. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about 1211?
So 1211 is to support survivors that are on their way to overcoming and aren't on their way to thriving. So really just to bring them out of surviving and into thriving. Like I said, this is a lifelong process for those who have been trafficked. So I want to be able to provide sustainable resources. And what that looks like is when survivors exit the life of trafficking and sexual exploitation, they are usually put into restorative care programs. Once they leave restorative care programs, it may be 18 months, it may be 2 years, then they are to be reintegrated back into the community. That's the point where 1211 comes in, because reintegration is hard for some. As I stated before, when you're a trafficking victim, that title, it includes so much. You're the lookout person, you're the maid, you're the runner, you're the keeper of all the drugs, you're the person that has the credit that they can mess up. And so when you come out of the life of trafficking, you have all these things, including charges on your record. Your criminal record is messed up, your credit is messed up. And so it's really hard for survivors to be reintegrated after program, when in program they're doing everything for you and you don't have to worry about that. But when you want to thrive and you want to, you're walking towards self-sufficiency, you really have to have the support that you need to really thrive in your communities, meaning access to jobs and livable wages, skills development so that you can go beyond livable wages, child care, you need access to legal. And so that's what 1211 is all about, is really supporting the survivor that have gone through programs and are on their journey of being reintegrated back into the communities. So again, from surviving to thriving.
What can we as a community, what can law enforcement, what can people in government do to stop human trafficking?
There are multiple answers to that. And I think we all can play our part. So there's laws that need to be changed. There's funding that is needed for organizations that are in this fight. There are schools that need to be educating our children. There are churches that need to be educated, communities that need to be educated and take a stand on a local level, all the way up to the federal level. And so I believe that just by learning about it is step number one. Don't be afraid to learn about this scary thing called human trafficking. The Epstein case is not just the first case. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of victims still out there that need our help. And there are children that are at risk that we need to protect them from these potential traffickers. So I think just really learning about the topic and find an anti-trafficking organization in your community, engage with them, ask them how you can support them. And that goes for law enforcement as well. But law enforcement need, you know, they need help and they need training on how to interact with victims when they encounter them on the street. And so all levels, it's a complex and a huge problem. But I think if we take our own little chunk out of it, I think everyone is able to do something, whether you are like you're doing something right now by providing a platform for awareness. That's huge. If someone likes to cook, find an anti-trafficking organization and, you know, teach survivors how to cook. So when they're reintegrated into the communities or reunited with their children, they can feed their families, you know? So it may seem little, whatever you have to contribute, but I would encourage people to contribute. That's a multifaceted question, a huge question, but I think that we all can do our part.
Well, I love the answer. I feel like those are tangible, at least for, you know, someone like me or someone who likes to cook, like you said, I feel like those are tangible ways people in the community, if they're saying, I feel like I need to do something, there is something to be done, and that a little goes a long way. Thank you so much for joining me today and providing me and my listeners with the unique perspective of someone who was a victim, who turned into a survivor and a thriver, and just the work you're doing, can't say enough. It's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you again for having me and for sharing yourself with the world too. There's a unique bond with trauma survivors. There's something that you just really can't verbalize what it is, but I feel that being here with you. And so thank you so much for providing the platform.
That was Kathy McGibbons, trauma survivor, thriver, sex trafficking advocate, and founder of 1211. If you want to learn more about Kathy, please visit my website, atstpodcast.com. That's the letter atstpodcast.com. There you can find a link to her website along with her social media handles, more about 1211. Please check it out and take a look at the resources that she has available for everyone. Thanks again for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Benstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.